none of us are platonic ideals. Kind of why I don't like Plato, right? We have this ideal, right? And then we fall short of it. The ideal gets us excited, and then we get unrealistic, and then we like ding ourselves, and then, oh my God, I was such in a rush today and or yesterday or whatever. What a hypocrite I am for writing this book about slowing down, where here I am, the author of this 420-page book about slowing down. But that's not really life. What it is a constant attention and returning and coming back and reinterpreting and building in systems in ourselves to the extent we can.
In today's far-ranging conversation, Andy Couturier illustrates what it could look like to design a life that's deeply aligned with values of minimal conscious consumption, rolling up our sleeves for our basic needs, and creating abundance of space and spirit through simplicity, elimination, and intentional choice. We also delve into writing as a powerful personal practice and how any expressive pursuit can act as a container for us to feel and live our lives more deeply. We came away inspired to look at the trade-offs inherent in our own lives with a conscious eye, and hope you will too.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Woven Wings Live. I'm Gabe Crane, and I'm joined by Rahul Deedwania, my co-host. And I'm really excited for the episode we've got on tap today. Today, we are welcoming Andy Couturier, who is the author of Writing Open the Mind and A Different Kind of Luxury. He's also my former, and I consider him my current writing teacher. Andy is an amazing writing teacher and also the founder and creative director of The Opening, which is a private writing school which offers courses in person and online. And today we're also going to be focusing on some of the core themes of his book, A Different Kind of Luxury, which was also reissued in a printing titled The Abundance of Less, Lessons in Simple Living from Rural Japan. And Andy is joining us today to share about that. And he has taken this not just in profiles of these Japanese people living in rural Japan, but with his own partner, has built a home in the California mountains using only hand tools. He lives there full time and enjoys doing things such as tree planting, splitting firewood, which just before we hopped on today, he told us that it's getting ready to rain and he's got to move that firewood into a dry area, home scale gardening and food production. And Andy loves to spend his mornings reading classical Chinese poetry or 20th century experimental imagist and nature poetry. And so there's a lot to look forward to in that. And I know I just introduced Andy, but before we bring him on, Rahul, curious, just your just quick take here on this notion of the abundance of less and anything you want to share before we bring Andy into the studio.
Hey, Gabe, good to be here with you as always. And this topic is something that, you know, the abundance of less, right? Even just the words, I think, hold a certain intrigue and power and potency to them. And I'm very excited to learn from Andy's example, from his story, from his exploration, and kind of see like what lessons to pull from and how to incorporate that into my own life, you know, because I think I'm definitely guilty to the scarcity mindset and feeling pulled in every which direction and eager to learn about an alternative way. So that's where I'm awesome. At.
Well, I hear those papers rustling, which I think is Andy moving around there. And so Andy, I just want to say, hey, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here, Gabe. Fantastic friendship I've already had with you. I do love your writing. I loved it the moment you walked into class, and I loved your mind, and you've been a help to me along the way. which has been a lovely thing. I think you're at least 20 years younger than me, and I feel that I've learned a lot from you. So a big honor to be with you, and I hope I can return the favor.
Yeah, well, it's a real honor to have you, and I think we're lucky to have you. I know you don't give too many of these interviews these days, and you are particular in your choice to give them. And one of the things I wanted to share right off the bat is just the way that you approached when I reached out to you, your response, which was this request to engage deeply with the materials of your book, of A Different Kind of Luxury, The Abundance of Less. And I found that so powerful. I loved that that was your request. And as a result, we ended up probably pushing back our recording time, maybe a couple weeks from when it would have been otherwise, and had a time, an opportunity to really dive in with this beautiful work that you've put together, which was just wonderful. I mean, it had a real impact on my psyche, on the things I was thinking about these last few weeks, and it's just been percolating around. And so I guess I'm curious, maybe just right there, why did you make that request, and why do you feel that's important to really have that genuine engagement when we're coming in to have a conversation like this?
Oh, well, that's a nice question, Gabe. And I'm so happy that it had an impact on your psyche. That's the answer to why does one write, is the hope that someone will have an impact, that it'll touch them or move them. Well, I've done, more than 100 events around the abundance of less, you know, all over the world, actually, China and Sri Lanka and all kinds of different locations over the world. And I've done some radio appearances where the very busy host just hasn't had time to look at it. So we're sort of starting, I guess, at a different place. And then I had one that was just amazing on a local radio station in Santa Cruz, where the person really had read the book through. She didn't do one radio show a week. She did one radio show a month, and God, it was one of the best interviews. And I felt like I learned a lot from it. And I feel like when I'm sharing some of the material to other people, I will point to that interview, even though it wasn't, say, maybe most listened to at the time of the different things I've done. It just felt like there was a deeper quality. And like you said before we started, there's a different kind of information in the field, which I really liked. So that was the reason for the request. I just thought it would make a better conversation.
There's this, this thought that's been percolating around since we hopped on the call here, which is I guess the cliche of it is less is more, but it's this sense of moving towards a single-minded focus or clearing out space to be present with something in a deeper way yields a much deeper experience of that thing, you know. And in this case, your book, the concepts that emerged from it, by doing less, I feel like I'm getting more through that. And I guess just to bring our listeners current, I think maybe the place to start is still to offer a kind of synopsis, kind of like a real 30,000 foot level summary of the book and the time you spent in Japan. One of the things that jumped out to me is a quote that one of your, the people that you profiled said, which is a comment about Thoreau, and this statement that Thoreau was really a tourist. When we go to like Walden Pond, that, you know, this iconic book on environmentalism or going back to the land in a certain way. But the reality is that Thoreau spent like 2 years living in this cabin, and the folks that you profiled in Japan have really made this their life. It's not a 2-year experiment. It's not something to write about. And that's also impacted your own life with the development of your own homestead in California. And so I guess I'm just curious if you can give us an overview of the deep end here that we're swimming in before we get into more details.
Okay. I'm a puckish character though, Gabe, as you know. So, I'll start 30,000 millimeters under the soil, or three millimeters under the soil. Because I do believe in, sort of a holographic theory of details, is that every little detail in some way contains, the whole. And I'll just start with something recent for me, and then maybe I'll move to Japan. Just went hiking in the Sierras with a friend, and I live in another part of California, quite far away, so there was a lot of driving involved. So, and then, you know, I had actually wanted to do it for 3 years, took 3 years for me to really make the time to have a slow enough time to we only spent 3 days in the backcountry, so it's not like a lot. Then I came back and spent a couple days in Berkeley and visited a whole bunch of friends and bought some books and got some food and all this stuff. And coming back, I just wanted to, yes, I had responsibilities. I'm teaching my writing class, my book completion group tonight. But to me, one of the most important things this afternoon when I'm done is to sit down with my journal and just write down what happened, what I thought, what my experiences were, to just hang out with all the things that happened. Because I feel like even if I wasn't on the internet the whole time, even if I wasn't checking my Twitter feed, which I don't have, it still felt like a fire hose of experiences, because I'm a very enthusiastic, bouncy person, and I wanted to see as many people as I could. And, you know, I ate at a number of different restaurants, and they were all delicious, and just to kind of look through what it is I did and settle into it and think again about the rest of the year, you know, how I want to engage my time, what I want to do in terms of my writing and my novel planning. And that, to me, if I didn't get to that this afternoon, I would be really, at this point, I don't know that I used to be, but at this point in my life, I'd be really bummed out if I didn't. And that feeling that I might be bummed out really is going to help me, because it's that richness that allows me to metabolize and digest what has occurred. So in terms of Japan, my partner and I, Cynthia, we went there in 1989. She and I have been together 36 years now. We went there not knowing that we were going to meet these amazing people, not knowing that there were people living slow, simple lives, growing their own food. In many ways, I thought at first it was sort of back to the past. I was quickly corrected, but, you know, they don't have television. They use very little plastic, if, you know, any at all. They heat their house with scraps of firewood that are laying around. They don't travel all over the place all the time. We just went over here there to, we heard we could teach English and earn money, and we wanted to buy a piece of property because both of us really love the natural world. We just love being out in the mountains with the moon shining on the snow, or catching the sight of a great blue heron, or growing your own food and harvesting. Oh my God, we have so many daikon sprouts right now, and I'm going to cook them up for lunch. And this is the life we wanted. So I know I was asked to be brief, so I'll try to go to the brief thing and let you guys ask some more questions. We, along the way of teaching English and saving money for the land that we did eventually buy, we met these people who, although they had many of the same values as we came over with, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, human-centered, community-oriented, social justice, all of those values, they really challenged us in profound ways to rethink how much of an industrial mindset we were still carrying with us. And maybe we'll get into that. And so I wrote the book because I thought they were extraordinary people. And I thought, wow, they're doing this in Japan, where, you know, dropping out is, I mean, it's at least here in the United States, people kind of have at least a cliche image of that, you know, but it's really, don't just drop back in. And it's very status oriented, very money oriented. I thought they must've had a lot of metal, M-E-T-T-L-E, to do it. And I wanted to understand the psychology, the inner sustainability, not the recycle the plastic bag mentality, but the inner sustainability. And that's what I wanted to share.
Yeah, and you framed the book as a portrait of stories rather than a manual for the good life. And you know, in some of the parts that I read, I saw that you were very careful to repeat that point, right? That, hey, this isn't meant to be prescriptive. This isn't meant to say, hey, this is how things should be. But in a way, you know, the values that you were alluding to were very much coming across, right? There is a thesis that's present or a point of view that's present in the story. And so the question here is like, what is the power of stories and why share your thesis in this particular way through these 10 different stories and then eventually adding on the 11th, your own?
It's a lovely, lovely question, and it is endlessly unanswerable and rich, and that's why we should spend time with it. And I'll actually go sideways because I always encourage, I like to encourage people to go on in an intellectual direction if they feel like it as well. I've been reading a book written in 73 by Jean-Paul Lyotard called The Postmodern Condition, and that's when the word postmodern was coined, and he's one of the key postmodern thinkers. And you're thinking, postmodernism? What are you talking about, Andy? And what he's talking about in this book is the way science is a narrative itself, and at the same time tries to delegitimize other ways of knowing, other narrative ways of knowing, other story ways of knowing, and breaks things up. This is back in 73 into small digital bits and bytes and, you know, 140 characters. Of course, that was not what he was talking about then, but how things get atomized and broken up into little pieces. And I think, you know, whether it's a difference between taking a walk, maybe everyone listening can imagine taking a walk in a beautiful natural area nearby your place versus watching a high production video of the most beautiful Himalayan mountain scenery with people skiing on it or parachuting off it, with every moment lasting for 2 seconds or a tenth of a second, you know, the jump cut, and having that blast by you. What would you rather do? And I just think that continuity allows a deepening and the shattering and breaking into little bits. Not that I'm against haiku. Haiku can be very powerful if you give it a space before it and after. But in general, when things are broken into the tiniest little digestible, you know, people ask me, what's the takeaway version of your book? You know, I'm in a hurry. I want to get the one key idea. It doesn't last. And I think I said something funny to somebody. It was a little puckish again, where it's like, the takeaway is that if you're looking for a takeaway all the time in the world, you're in a lot more trouble than you know.
Yeah. So I think when I hear that description, it's the, you know, the stories are this invitation to, I mean, there are many things, but one thing they are is an invitation to slow down and engage with the material rather than in a soundbite or in a bullet point. It within the narrative, and the narrative of that you share about these portraits of these different people, it expresses so much more, you know, kind of in a holistic sense that you can't capture when you boil it down into, you know, the takeaway. Nice. And to me, you know, that kind of the person that straw man you just set up for us of who's in a rush and trying to get out, you know, I think I can speak for certainly, obviously myself, but I would imagine for a lot of people where I've totally got that straw man inside me. You know, I mean, today my son is a little under the weather. He's home. I've got to, you know, manage that. I've got to do my work. It's like estimated taxes are due today. You know, it's like there's all sorts of things going on. And this modern life revs us up and speeds us up. And running throughout, you know, and this book and really, I feel like within this thesis of like the abundance of less, there's this real movement of slowing down. And you speak to this throughout the book of reducing our needs and consumption, getting in touch with ourselves. There's a quote from the book that says to set a pace slow enough to observe the processes of the mind, or having more time than things to do makes that those things more pleasurable. So I'm curious if you can illuminate this for us. What is the power of slowing down and the necessity of slowing down to access the abundance that you're talking about?
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to do that. So let me just first make a couple things clear. I also am not any kind of paragon. And I think probably even the people I write about, they're not paragons because none of us are Platonic ideals. Kind of why I don't like Plato, right? We have this ideal, right? And then we fall short of it. The ideal gets us excited and then we get unrealistic and then we like ding ourselves. And then I think Rahul said, guilty to the scarcity mindset. That's like, I don't know. I feel that one of the things to think about is what's effective, right? Not what's right, wrong. What's effective in having a more rich life? So I think if feeling ourselves guilty works to create a richer, better life, all for it, I guess. You know, I think, or like, oh my God, I was such in a rush today or yesterday or whatever. What a hypocrite I am for writing this book about slowing down, where here I am, the author of this 420-page book about slowing down. But that's not really life. What it is a constant attention and returning and coming back and reinterpreting and building in systems in ourselves to the extent we can. And many people are not in a position to do anything but just, make it through the hailstorm of expectations and rent payments, and it's a predatory system that we live in. So let's be really careful that people don't get into, I think maybe it's a bit Catholic or something like that, you know, the guilt thing. Just to more be alive to, and maybe this is a good, let me finish that sentence. To be alive to how cool and wonderful it is when we are able to get into the slow space, and how I really want to move towards that. So people ask me when they come to me, I've got to get disciplined about working on my book. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really a fan of discipline. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of hierarchical relationship with yourself, right? You've got a boss inside of you shouting at you, which is another reason why we don't have prescriptive things. Like, you know, how many books have you bought? 50 Ways to Save the Planet. Don't do this and do that. You know, you might use a few of them, but in some sense it causes a rebel movement inside of you. Like, to hell with that, you know, stop telling me what to do. So it's more about, you know, no one has to discipline themselves to eat chocolate. Mm-hmm. So I would say, really settle into what's pleasurable. And to be able to, as much as you're able to, with the support of your community, with the support of good books, with the support of talking to friends, with the support of meditation, which I know you're a very big part of. Gabe, you have a Tai Chi Qigong practice. All of these things are really ways to just work in relation to the system of responsibilities and things that are coming at you. So, Gabe, you mentioned about, you know, taxes and your son and work to do and things like that. And so there's just a lot of things that come into design, and we get better and better at it, I think, or hopefully we could get better and better at it as we get older. So, for me, one of the design features, I don't want to call it that because, you know, Cynthia and I have never really wanted to have kids, and I love children, but it's just that I realized, I saw people who had kids, you know, kids are need a lot of care. They run up to you, they interrupt. There's probably someone right now caring for your son so that you can have a slow conversation. Mm-hmm. So we have to really think about community and appreciation of that person or people who are answering his mm-hmm. little questions or helping him with his cough or helping bring his fever down. I want to say that, like, you know, for us, that was something that we decided to not have as part of our I need to get this done. And then I guess another part, just since you brought up taxes, my partner is now doing the taxes that we should have filed a year ago. So, you know, we might get in trouble with the government. Get to it when we get to it. You know, I don't need to internalize the, you know, authoritarianism of the United States government. Like, you know, and, you know, and who knows, you know, we could say that maybe when I'm at the end of my life, I don't have any children to be looking after my nursing care. And I could be in a state of suffering because I made that choice now. Or, you know, if the IRS comes after me and charges us all this money for, you know, not doing it, then I guess I'll have to pay them. It's just, I think it's just, I'm telling a lot of different pieces to this as they come to me. But I think in many ways, it's just having enough time to reflect, as one of the people in my book says, time to simply stop and think. How is this working for me? How can I change it? What are the ways that I have power in the situation or privilege in the situation? What ways can I use that honorably and best? What ways am I just not in control of the situation? And, you know, I'm just going to have to speed up. I mean, if I saw an accident on the street and an injured person, I'm not going to think, well, I better do this really slow or something. No, I'm going to run. I'm going to go and help as best I can in the fastest possible way I can. So important not to have too many monotheistic ideas about how to, you know, even this word, the slow life, you know, oh my God, I was rushing.
Yeah. It's funny. Even as you mentioned all that, this idea of like having time to slow down and to reflect and to just be, I'm thinking about my version of that over the last year and a half or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I basically end up scheduling time to be and to not and to slow down. And the irony of that is not lost on me. And you know, what I was just thinking about when you mentioned systems earlier, right? And this idea of like bringing your attention back to what your real intention is and creating space for that. And systemizing it then too, and making it meet the needs of the moment, right? Understanding that life changes, demands on us change, and you know, no matter what your circumstances are. I'm just curious, while we're here, to ask, I guess, a more pointed question around what are your systems, or have you gone about designing, you know, that space for yourself and all that?
Well, one of my systems is scheduling time to slow down. So I don't have an irony in that at all. And I might I might surprise you, but if you think about, there's a Jewish tradition of Shabbat, which is one day a week of not working. A wonderful book by one of my writing students, Marilyn Paul is her name. It's called An Oasis in Time. An Oasis in Time, to make sure that you have that one day every week that is not about getting the firewood in and not about fencing the ground squirrels out of your tomatoes, even if they are eating your tomatoes, or not replying to the new student who wants to take a writing class, even though if I don't jump on it right now, she may take another writing class. It's my Shabbat. And at the same time, I had something scheduled for a Shabbat day. It's actually an interview, another interview, and they couldn't make it on the day that we have our Shabbat. So I really wanted to do this interview, and you know, it's a really big audience, and I want to get the work out. So I talked to my partner. I was like, "Can we reschedule our Shabbat? Oh, and also, since the rain's coming, that's that day of Saturday that usually is our Shabbat is the last sunny day. Like later in the day, it is going to start raining. We could be like, okay, we're going to be slow and just let the firewood get, that's going to bite us in the butt very seriously in November or February when all our firewood's wet. So, you know, flexibility in that. So that's one thing. Another thing is, I teach 16 hours a week. That is the maximum. I don't teach any more than that. And I, at this point, there's a whole lot of people signing up to my classes. And I'm like, oh, I could make more money, but I know it's going to happen to me. I'm getting tired and depleted. I won't teach as well. I'll just be miserable. So not having a lot of money go out causes me to have a lot more time. So one of the reasons we left Santa Cruz is we were paying with the office, you know, $2,000 a month, even though Cynthia and I, we lived in a studio apartment. We still live in a one room place. People say, oh, you have to have a two bedroom or a four bedroom or something like that. It's like, okay, you know, I understand how that's more comfortable or that's easy, or, you know, you can shut out the noise in a certain way or spread your arms more, but that causes you to have to work harder to make more money, and you'll never get the time back from that money. So it's really, you know, designing, so we get a lot of clutter in the house, and sometimes it's hard to move around. I got to take some time out to put things away, or sometimes we're both trying to cook in the kitchen or bumping into each other, or there's a bunch of things, you know. But those are actually real limits that, say, a deer in the forest has limits, or squirrels, or earthworm. That's what's caused them to look like they do and be as beautiful as they are, is the limits, the ecological limits, the coming of winter, the scarcity of food at certain times. These are all, and we've been taught, particularly if you're from the United States, that more, and I've got to have, and it's me, it's mine, and, you know, I'm incomplete until I buy this thing. And, you know, how many garages in Topeka, Kansas are just crammed to the gills with, you know, exercise bikes and, flotation rafts and three kayaks. And then we have to maintain it. And then the rat gets in there and it bites the electrical cord, and we got to maintain that. And all of a sudden it's like, there's so much to do. How did this happen to me? It's like, and it's a colonial mindset, I think. Like, I'm going to take it. It's mine. And I don't have time to clean my house. I'm going to hire someone to come in and clean my house because I can't stand it being dirty. We've never liked having a relationship with another human being that person is our servant, and we make more money than they do. So we pay them to, like, make our kitchen look cleaner. I'd rather have a dirtier kitchen. And we do have a dirty kitchen. We'll wipe off a couple of counters and cook on that. So this whole, you know, it goes all the way back to stealing the land from the Native Americans and stealing, you know, and then charging rent on the property that we own. And then, you know, using that money to fly to Paris to, like, eat in a nice restaurant. It's a whole system of, like, extraction. And so in many ways, I don't want to have anything to do with that. Not that I'm not part of it. I am part of it. And it's just a matter of reducing it as much as I can. I mean, for environmental reasons, but also for joy of having time to talk with friends. And then, you know, I talked to somebody who said, you know, to have a real friendship with someone, they have to have time in their room in their calendar for me. And this friend that I went hiking with for 5 days, he has room in his calendar. You know, we could spend 5 days together. I have another friend who I really love. But, like, every time I try to schedule, he reschedules, he needs to reschedule, he can't make it, he has to cancel, you know, there's no room there. He's a very excited person. He's got a lot of things he wants to do. But in terms of sitting down and hanging out for hours and being with each other, he's too busy for that. And I don't think we can really have a friendship. And it's heartbreaking, but, you know, there are limits, and that I'm just adapting to that.
So much of what you shared there, just name that again about limits. And I hear that process of really relating with our desires and that desire to go do this, that, the other thing, and running through, I think, your whole lifestyle and approach, and certainly through the book, is a deep inquiry into an alternative to that Western colonialist viewpoint that you just described, which is Buddhistic and is about the reduction or the cessation of desire. And I'm curious, because earlier you talked about following what's pleasurable, and that also being part of finding the way into something that is more abundant and more sustainable. So can you help us disentangle those things?
Sure.
I think, you know, I speak for myself. I think I speak for Rahul too. We're both people who like to do a lot of stuff. I've got way too many things going on. So how do we navigate between that? How do we continue to flow towards what's pleasurable while having this more intricate or sophisticated relationship with our desire? I don't know if sophisticated is the right word there, but how do we manage that relationship so that it can be more effective?
Well, I think I'm going to surprise you again. I'm really into desire. I think desire is a delicious thing. I love carnivals. I love festivals. Mm-hmm. I love really making yummy food, sensuality with my partner, you know, all of that. It's just great. So that's where I'm, you know, I've been a regular or irregular meditator for 30 years. I've studied a lot of Buddhism. I think it's a great body of teaching. But I'm also a person who wants to attend a carnival and just be in the explosion of color and sound and dance and pleasure space of the world. And I don't want to go to that thing, oh, you have to keep it in a balance. I actually really don't like the word balance because it feels like static thing. I think it's dynamic, moving and adjusting and pulling back and rushing forward. So for you, Gabe, you made a choice to launch Woven Wings as a podcast, and that's going to impinge on your schedule, and it's going to impinge on, you're going to have to edit this interview. And so you, I guess at points will be thinking, you know, is this, you know, it's probably time away from being with your young son, right? So, you know, thinking about that and just being a little bit like, here's something I say to some of my writing students. They're like, and I, people are like, oh, just help me make more time. And I'm like, I used to try to help. I do still try to help with that thing, but I don't want to get into fighting people's to-do lists because I can't do it. And, I don't even like the word priorities. So say someone is like about to, they're thinking about like the next week, they have a weekly class. They've come to me, they paid money to be in a book completion group, right? They want to complete their book, or part of them says they want to complete the book. And I'll just use a random person's name, Roberto. I'm just pulling it out. I say, Roberto, next time you're deciding to go hiking or play video games instead of working on your book, do the following exercise. Walk into the bathroom, look in the mirror, say to yourself, I, Roberto, am now choosing to play video games or go out for a nice dinner in a restaurant and not work on my book. Just look at yourself. And as long as you're not doing it furtively and you're making that choice, I think eventually things will settle themselves out because you're being conscious. So that's the Buddhist part, I guess, is what am I actually doing? And again, these are ideas for me, and I will say that I have put them into practice, and I do put them into practice, and I'm better at putting them into practice. But I was raised in the United States of America, and I have an excited mind. I have a lot of things to think about, a lot of things I want to do. And, you know, it's, I don't talk too much about the abundance of less now because I'm moving on to my novel. So right now I'm decided to do this interview, and I'm having a great time doing it, talking to my old friend Gabe, to be of service. And I am choosing to not, you know, I finished the novel, but I have to have, you know, book proposal, and it needs to be written. So I'm choosing, I, Andy Couturier, am choosing not to work on the book proposal in order to have a conversation with Gabe and Rahul. And I'm like, okay, good. I am choosing to do that. And, part of it is how much I respect your mind, Gabe, and, how rich it is for me to interact with you.
This piece really speaks to me. You know, I think there's this statement out there, right? Like, hey, your life already reflects your priorities because you're doing, you know, you're choosing whether implicitly or explicitly to do the things that you're doing for a reason. And I've always struggled with that a little bit, I think in part because of some of the things you even said earlier, Andy, which is like, we don't always know what's guiding us to do something. And there are these invisible forces of the society that we're in, the culture that we're in. I know you speak to this a lot in your book as well. And it's like, it's just this idea that like what changes that relationship is that moment of acknowledgement, right? Of awareness and conscious choice that, hey, I'm doing this and I choose to do this and that's okay, you know, or that's what I want in this particular moment. And it's just interesting to me because I think for me, this relationship with time, you know, is something that's come up time and time again. I've had conversations with Gabe about this at length. You know, I'm like, hey, I always feel like I don't have enough time to do the things I want to do, or I, you know, I'm hungry to do all these things. And how do I do all these things? And I think inherent to what you're saying is at any given moment, you have a choice, right, around what to do and what you want. And, you know, whether you call it prioritizing or not, it's just this thing of like, in the moment you can choose. And what also comes with that, I think, is the trade-off, right? An acceptance that you're choosing to do one thing and not another, and to be accepting of that notion. And I'm curious for you, or just more generally, like what your perspective is on that notion of acceptance and how you cultivate that acceptance. And as part of that, you know, if you even want to go into some of the trade-offs that you've made and what your journey was with accepting those trade-offs and being not just at peace, but at pleasure with those trade-offs, I would love to hear about that.
Sure. well, I want to bring something into the room first. And I'll start with something that Atsuko said. Atsuko Watanabe is in chapter 2 of The Abundance of Less. And she was the person who introduced me to many of the people in the book. And she talked about traveling in India, coming from Japan, not as wealthy when she was a young woman as it is now, but it was still plenty wealthy. And she was traveling through Pakistan and seeing people living on dirt floors, with barely a little bit of rice and dal. And she, I think she's somebody I would say is, you know, has part of her personality set up is a judgmental mindset, which as we know can go towards ourselves. And I think that can be useful sometimes. And she's like, I look at my life, I've got a car that's more than enough, thinking about all the people who are really have nothing. So, I think it's really important in this conversation that we're having to realize, you know, I have had a lot of privilege. I'm white, male, heterosexual, living in the United States of America without any major disabilities, to make the choices I have to, you know, go overseas, to buy this property. I've had a lot of support. And so my job is to be aware of that, give back as much as I can. You know, a generosity economy is a really big part of what I believe in. And I need to, in a humble and vulnerable way, realize how many, you know, there's, you know, we read these statistics about how many people, like their kids are hungry right now. They have nothing to eat. And their, you know, rent is going up, or they might be evicted, or they've been assaulted by the police, or they've been sexually assaulted and their children are, I mean, it's just a lot of stuff that is not just sort of like we can control it. So I think it's just not to feel like, oh, I'm guilty, it's my fault, etc. You know, unless that's useful to you, I guess. But just kind of bow my head and just be in a space of quiet and grieving, maybe is a word, and honoring and thinking about it. So I think that is a good antidote to like, every last pleasure I want to have, I'm going to have it now. So yeah, I want to do all these things, like going back to the trip to the Sierras. Wanted to do it last year. Wanted to do it the year before. And Yeah, in some ways it was like a trade-off. So this, let me get to this. I think this is kind of a subtle thing. So it's how we work with our psychology. Okay, so I wanted to go to the Sierras 2 years ago, and whatever, I was, quote, too busy, or I was working on something else, or, you know, it wasn't going to work with my partner, or who's going to take care of the dog, or, so I didn't do it. And I was like, probably had a little moment of like, no, I mean, maybe it's sort of like, let's say you're at a carnival. I don't know why carnival's coming up for me today, but, and you're, you know, you get the three balls and you're supposed to knock the plates off, right? And you don't, you knock off two and you don't knock off the third one and you don't get the teddy bear, right? You're like, oh, I lost. Then you move on. Whatever. you know, then you like turn back to your friend and hold her hand, or, you know, like watch the lights in the sky of the Ferris wheel, and you're not like, I didn't get the teddy bear constantly. So I think kind of chewing on, I didn't get it, I want it. This is just how it's evolved for me. I mean, certain things are very big disappointments that I wanted. I try it again. Eventually I did go to the Sierras, believe it or not, a different kind of luxury. I wrote the newspaper articles. And again, to remind the listeners, A Different Kind of Luxury is the original name of The Abundance of Less. It's basically the same book, slightly different. A Different Kind of Luxury. I wrote, I wanted to go back to Japan in 98, 99. We did. And I wrote for the Japan Times and I put a book proposal together, and that book proposal was ready by 2001, even got a bite from a publisher in 2002. And I thought, great, you know, it's gonna be published. That book did not get published until 2010. So yeah, there was a moment, you know, I want to have a book published, or I believe in this book, or blah, 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 you know, just didn't happen then. And probably a lot of the things I dream of having is aren't going to happen, but, and I try to stop with this one, is I have an idea of building a whole bunch of little cottages around on our property. We have 27 acres. And I'd like to build these little writer's cottages because I like building things. And I'd like to invite people over. But I also know that I'm 58 years old and that, you know, I don't have as much energy as I used to. And we're not going to use power tools, and it's going to be a lot of time and money and not doing other things. So maybe I won't get to do that fun thing. I mean, tree houses and cabooses and underground places. And I have this dream fun, like kind of hobbit hole of all these different little places, and then offering them to artists and writers and activists to hang out with no rent. This is like my fantasy. I'm enjoying that right now by talking about it. I'm enjoying the fantasy of having it, of drawing the pictures in my mind. Just like we enjoy a dream, some dreams, we enjoy an image in a dream. Wow, that'd be fun. I'm just enjoying being in that house. If that house doesn't end up happening, those little cottages don't happen. I've already had a lot of the pleasure anyway.
That's so powerful. I really love where you took us there, Andy, and it leads me to want to dive in a little bit more to your practice and identity as a writer.
Okay.
And the way that writing relates to these different topics and themes that we've been exploring. And I guess one of the first things that jumps out to me in reading your work and then spending time with you today is the depth of reflection, self-awareness. Sure. I think I find myself being invited into that process with you just by virtue of spending time with you, engaging with the writing before this, where there's a raising of awareness, a raising of consciousness that comes about through, you know, your perception and the way that you're engaging with the materials of your life. And so one of the things that came up for Rahul and I when we were preparing for this episode was just reflecting on that and thinking about this whole notion of the abundance of less and the relationship that writing has to that whole concept. I think what is like the exact question I want to ask? I think there's a way that it seems that the process, your process of writing itself may have deepened your understanding of things and influenced the decisions you've made around how you've ended up designing your own life. And I'm curious if you can help us make those connections. Like, what is the power of the practice of writing in the journey to finding this abundance of less that we're discussing today?
Lovely question. And we could do a 3-hour episode on that because I love talking about writing. And I'll mention that I do have that time. So that's a nice thing to have. Let's start with what's coming up to me. Let me tell you a story of being in Japan in 1990. So at that time, I would have been 26 years old. And we were working a lot because, as I said, we were there to make money. And I had just come out of UC Santa Cruz and with a lot of really great radical leftist professors. And they, you know, I was learning a ton about gender inequity and feminism. I almost did a women's studies major or a minor, didn't quite finish it, but studied that a lot. Was very involved in work with Native peoples as a college student and sensitized to issues of race and racism in the United States. And so I had all of these thoughts, right, and all of these concepts. And then, like, you know, fast forward year and a half, 2 years later, we're in Japan, and two little incidents that I'll go very briefly over. One is I'm teaching at a company, and the guys, all men, invite me out because they really like my teaching. They decide to spend money to take me out to a hostess bar, and I don't want to insult them, right? And I have these sort of complex feelings, like, you know, these are people of color, these Japanese men, right? Now all of a sudden I'm in this place where this woman who's like 30 years younger than them is being paid to put her hand on their thighs, you know? And I'm like, I don't want to be part of this. And it was just this mess in my mind. You know, it was like, but I want to be, you know, these people are trying to be nice to me. I couldn't figure it out. Writing was the only way to just write all these things out. I had another incident where I was teaching a young married woman in her like early 30s, and she was, you know, full of, you know, rouge and mascara and pink, and she was had quite good English, and she was wanted me to help her express her feelings that the proper role of a wife was to be subservient to her husband and to, you know, service is every need and desire, and that that is what makes a good marriage. And inside my head, I'm screaming, like, ah, what am I supposed to do? You know, like, I'm not going to, you know, a little part of me just wanted to shout at her, but you can't. You're this white guy, colonialist in Japan, you're going to shout at this woman of color. Things are complicated in the world. Things are really interwoven with so many different narratives. This is another reason why the sort of prescriptive stuff is fails, because it's two-dimensional. So writing in both of those instances, I wrote some essays about it, and I realized how much I wanted to write, and I loved writing, and I wrote some essays, and they immediately got published because I was talking about an experience. I mean, I worked really hard on them, and they were, you know, nice national magazines, blah, blah, blah. But, and so I felt a little ego. That's nice. I wrote this thing, but I think it's like really spending some time thinking about things that are complicated for you. So again, if I don't have any time to consider it, then it's all on autopilot. Oh my God, I got to get to the meeting and I'm late because I haven't planned well, or because I've just filled myself life up with, I want this, that, and the other thing. And I don't have time to eat. I'm super hungry and the meeting's gone. I'm going to grab a to-go bagel and a to-go cup and the styrofoam, and I'm going to like slug down the coffee and stuff the bagel in my mouth. And that's how we get to unsustainable life ways, is because we're constantly on that. We're like, how did this happen to me? How did this happen to me? And I think those of us who do have some ways of changing things in their lives, even if we're habitual creatures, which we are, it's incumbent on us to start to try to design our lives for that. In terms of writing, I think in the material you sent me, you asked me to share a poem or something. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to share? And I just randomly opened up a page. So I do have that for later, but if you want. But I realized looking at this short little thing that I wrote, and it was really just like a quick free write, how much I loved language itself and how much I love the sounds of words and love the texture of and the rhythm and the power of the rhythm and the clatterings of the consonants and the ululations of the vowels. And so the pleasure space of being in writing, just self-expression, creativity of any kind. And many people like to sing, or many people like to dance, or there's other forms of creativity, painting. But for me, the engagement with language has always been central, and it's connected to ideas, but I also like to disconnect from ideas. I think I'm wandering a little bit away from your question there. Maybe if I haven't covered it, you'd like to re-ask it. I'm sorry if I have.
No, I think you're definitely giving voice to it. I mean, part of what I'm hearing is that writing about these situations that confront you has invited deeper understanding and a process of coming to terms with not making peace, but making pleasure. I like that concept that's kind of come through of these challenging experiences. And so it feels like it's a way of similarly to mindfulness, but in a different expression, it's a way of becoming more conscious. And therefore, in a certain way, writing into being a different state for yourself, a different state of awareness or a different understanding. I'm curious if that resonates or seems like it
exactly
summarizes
correct.
Well.
I can't say it any better. Perfect. Just what you said, Gabe. Thank you for shortening it.
Yeah, and one thing I was sharing with Gabe earlier that I'd love to share with you too, Andy, is for me, like, writing is a very recent exploration and literally like this year. And there was one, you know, sort of writing piece in particular that really opened me up to the power of writing for myself, which was just writing about these two grandfather figures in my life that had passed away this year. And it wasn't actually until I wrote about them and their impact on me and like who I am and just their influence on the way that I think and what I appreciate and value that I even felt, like, it wasn't until I wrote about it that I really felt my connection to them, you know, to a point where my wife was even like, oh, I didn't realize you felt this way about them or that you were that connected to them. And I was like, yeah, I didn't know that either, you know? And it wasn't until the writing process created the container or the space for me to go into that, right? And more than even what I wrote, I would say it was, I think, just having that time and that space to connect with it, that it really opened that up for me. And like you said, I think a number of different practices or you know, different things that people can do, whether it's singing, dancing, any of those kinds of things can do that. But you know, just as it relates to writing, that was eye-opening for me, you know, and it's something that's really elevated this idea of creating room for that kind of endeavor again, whether it's writing, whether
Beautiful.
It's dancing, whether it's something else, or even this podcast, you know,
right.
I think is a version of that as well.
Rahul, can I just say, and you might have a question for me, but just briefly, that's beautiful. And it's a form of grieving. And one of my teachers says, I grieve by cherishing. And I feel like probably I'm imagining you're cherishing these two grandfather figures. And it's an honoring of their lives and it's praising of who they were. And I don't think, I'll go out on a limb, that after spending that time writing it, you thought, oh, I could have been doing something else, or like, how am I going to fit in 100 other things? You were just at that moment of writing it, like, just grateful that you had the time or the capacity to write, or that those insights came through to you. And I think that's the answer of, you know, not that like I have to balance work and life, or I have to, you know, control my desire. It's just like, I did this and I connected with these two men. And not only did I honor what they gave me, I probably cemented it. And then you shared it with another person, your wife, who like got to know who you were. And perhaps that was a profound moment for her to understand you through the writing that you expressed by sharing it with her.
Thank you for that, Andy. And I would say that very perfectly encapsulates what my experience was, you know, through that. And definitely something that's sparked me to want to seek out a little bit more of that. And, you know, might use that as the segue to ask you to share that piece of writing that you alluded to earlier. I would love to love to hear it and be a part of that.
Okay. So thanks. And I do, you did send me a little note about, you know, the challenge of doing this yourself. And I'd love to really dive into that, because I think a lot of times I get people, they read the book and they're like, it's lovely, I can apply a little bit of it, but I'd never want to, I could never live that way. So let's not neglect to have you really challenge me. And I'd like to really invite you, when we do that, to ask the uncomfortable question, or even the question that someone might think might be rude question. Go ahead and do that. But as a segue, as an intermediate moment, I would like to share a piece of writing, since you invited that, that isn't about meaning. So we've been spending this whole, we've been talking for about an hour now, deep in meaning making, exchanging ideas, asking questions, painting pictures, telling stories, lovely ways to use language. You also asked some like exercise someone might be able to use in writing that might bring them closer to this sense of abundance. And so if I have 90 seconds in the elevator, let's call it the elevator. I'd love to do more writing, but I don't know how to do it and I'm stuck. And I will say, fetishize the sound of the words. Escape from the cage of say what you mean. Escape from the cage of say what you mean. Just be in the pleasure state of language itself. And so I more or less randomly opened a journal and found this, you know, before our call today. But I thought, oh, I'll share this. So for people who are not used to regularly listening to language as a thing in of itself, just encourage you to just let it wash over you, not try to figure it out, and just enjoy the texture of the sounds, if you like to. Here it is. The lichen-covered penumbra undulates, expands, growing up like granite bubble from the Cretaceous, pitching it forward like angstroms from Dang. The loose licks from matted sticks subdue the firehouse of Ur. Hee-haw had to hoof it out of here, like anarchy measured by the dram, encoding a lion's mane of glum. I had fun writing that.
I love the ending. It's very, yes, I actually loved all of it, but the ending on glub is very, it's abrupt and, yeah, just makes it
so much kinda, texture.
Yeah, brings words. The whole thing home. Thanks for sharing that, Andy. I really appreciate that. And thanks for sharing something that, yes, kind of upends the rich meaning making focus that we've been in and that we often are in this show. And I guess I'm curious, as you alluded to, we did ask if there is some sort of exercise you might be able to share with us and our listeners, for people to kind of get into the practice. I think you provided that elevator speech of, you know, getting into the sounds, but is there an exercise that people can do to start to open up writing as a tool for them in their own meaning making, their own spiritual life and engagement?
Sure. So this will be from Writing Open the Mind, my book. It's called Tapping the Subconscious to Free the Writing and the Writer. And just to say, if people want more resources, I'd love to give them away. They are on my website at theopening.org. And there's, if you go to the About the Author page or About the Instructor page, there's some free handout exercises that you can do, a lot of sort of basic introductory ones. But, I would also just say, first of all, making time for it, making the value for it, removing some distractions from your life for even a little bit, and just letting the pen go, not judging. So the three rules of free writing, which underscore all of the exercises, or I like to call them experiments, in writing Open the Mind are: keep the pen moving, don't read back, don't scratch out. Feeling great, keep the pen moving. Feeling terrible, keep the pen moving. Sure, it's the worst crap anyone's ever written, keep the pen moving. Tears pouring down your face, keep the pen moving. And don't read back and don't scratch out are about not triggering the fear response, which makes writing worse and makes the writing experience worse. And criticism: is this bad? Is this good? Did I enjoy this? Any of that garbage. So within that framework, there's a exercise called Falling Into Natural Beings, The Lure of the Sensuous. Falling Into Natural Beings, The Lure of the Sensuous. And I would say you could do this with any object in your house. It wouldn't even have to be a natural object. But let's say you have a flower in your house, or let's say there's a pine cone outside your front door, or let's say there's if you're Gabe, a banana leaf in Hawaii, and it catches your attention and you're excited by it. Now, this is not actually an exercise I usually do as an intro exercise, because it's a little maybe it's a little trickier. Maybe it's easier. I think a kid could do this quite easily. So if you access your own kid, so you go and you first take this being, this natural being. We don't deny its sentience. Maybe it's a rock. We don't call it an inanimate object. We just call it its thing. And you just start by describing it. You know, that just gets you into it. And describing everything you can about it, just keeping the pen moving. Timed free write is usually good. So you keep the pen moving the whole time, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, how much time you have. Set a timer, get rid of the other distractions. And let's just say you use a rock and it just appeals to you. You pick up the rock. Maybe you bring it into your house and put it on your lap as a big rock, or maybe you just sit down next to it outside and you start describing it. And that's just a basic writing exercise of perception and getting into it. Its interior, its surface. And then you start to think about how writing about it and relating to it is changing you, how you are in participation with it, not just perceiving it from the outside and looking at it, but you're in some way participating with it. And then, so that's part two, is just letting that participation, how the rock and you being together, this interspace between the two of you, is changing you. Part three is to write, now this is where it gets trippy, is to write, to change to inarticulate syllables or non-meaning syllables. So you're not writing words. What does the surface? I'm thinking about a granite rock right now. Look, 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 and I'll write GLCK, GLCK, GLCK down. And then I'll see the shimmer of the light on the little pieces of quartz and feldspar in the rock. And I'll see it now, maybe, because to me, that's what the light hitting these little pieces of quartz, PTK, something like that. So I'm actually moving out of the thinking space with that, and I'm actually relating on this deeper level with it. And then I do that for a while, keep going. It's actually sort of impossible to translate a rock into words, but its very impossibility actually causes different things to happen. And you can, once you get that going for a while, then you can allow yourself to write a word that comes out of that sound. So like for me, particulate, petticoat, perquacky, I don't know what those words are, but they would come out of my pen to just be in the space. And then to finally move to what I don't know, what is mysterious, what will never be known. Not in order to say, God, I wonder if it was formed in the, you know, Paleolithic period, or how did this rock get here, or what's the effect of gravity? I mean, those are okay, but the things that to be in a deeper space of really not the deep mystery of this particular piece of granite sitting on your lap in your chair as you're writing about it, the things that are unknowable to you, and write into that. And I will guarantee you, if you go through that process or even part of that process, that that 10 minutes that you just spent with that will stay with you for 5 years, 10 years, that there's an intimacy that has built up between you and that rock, and rocks that are like that, that you meet later in your life. And the concept and being of rock will stay with you. And it's a really fun, exercise to deepen into your own perceptual, sensual field.
Thanks for that, Andy. That was a trip, just imagining doing the exercise. So doing the exercise itself, I think will be a real trip. And yes, I think I'm curious, Rahul, if you have anything else, but I have one more question for you today, which I think links to something you were naming in that exercise, which is about participation. And this goes back to your experience of the abundance of less. And I'm going to tie a few things together here. That the first is that these people, remarkable people that you profiled in this book, would not have had their story known to me for as just one individual and the other people who encountered your book without your engagement and participation with them in the experience of their life and the description of it by you. And secondly, then, I think there's a strong theme that runs through the book around this notion of doing things yourself, DIY, getting it done outside of the, you know, industrial like processes that make things easier for us to do, but also distance ourselves from the actual product of building your own cabin, right? Like you and Cynthia built your own cabin with hand tools. And there's something that you write about that is particular to that experience and a value and pleasure you get from that. And so there is this DIY theme that runs throughout, but then at the same time, here's this notion of the participation. And I think about it with Cynthia being a constant presence through your journey, through Japan, building your homestead in California. And so this participation with others, getting help from others in the writing exercise where you're describing participating with the what some people would call an inanimate object, but an element of nature. And I would just ask if you can help us to understand that or to share your own understanding of that now, the tension and the distinction between doing it yourself, and that maybe this view, maybe it goes to that Thoreau vision that we kind of started out at the beginning of like being alone in your hut in the woods and some of the criticisms that can come along with that. Mm-hmm. And the deeper experience of participation, of deep experience or communion in a kind of community with others, human and otherwise. And can you help us make sense of that when we think about the abundance of less? What role does that participation and community play?
Wow, very rich question. I knew I'd love talking with you, Gabe. Okay. So let's start with Thoreau. Many people don't know that Thoreau, I've read this, I guess this is true because I've read it a couple different places. While he was living at Walden Pond, he was outside of the town of Concord, Massachusetts. He sent his laundry back to town for his mother to do. His mother did his laundry, which is not to denigrate the important, especially around civil disobedience. So, you know, this is, you know, Thoreau is also extremely important in terms of he actually went to jail, refusing to participate in an economy of slavery in the 1850s. And interestingly enough, Thoreau and Emerson were very important inspirations for Mohandas Gandhi. And Mohandas Gandhi was a very important inspiration for Martin Luther King. And I'm just you know, these are just names of men here, but these are, you know, mass movements of people who are moved by powerful ideas to work together to create a better world. So many of the people in the book, for example, work on anti-nuclear issues, another issue that seems to be coming up again now with the new legislation coming out of Congress, which we guess we're mostly all happy for. But there's money, a lot of money in there to keep nuclear plants open. And, you know, and so, you know, that's a clear and present danger, not for just us. I imagine that you might be thinking, could be thinking about your son living in a world with a Chernobyl scale nuclear disaster spreading, you know, chromosome damaging, cancer causing poison all over the world. So looking at that and saying, I don't want to have that happen in my world. And as much as I would love to go swimming at the beach today in Maui, I feel like I need to make some movement to prevent, to understand a little bit about that bill or something. This is a big thing for many of the people in Japan. They would have loved to just spend their lives, you know, growing vegetables. But the government of Japan was citing nuclear, so the citing nuclear plants all over. There's like 53 in Japan, like way before Fukushima disaster happened. There was just, you know, nuclear accident after nuclear accident after nuclear accident. And people have to come together, as in the civil rights movement, as in the abolition movement that Thoreau was part of and wrote about and inspired people to work with each other. We are now talking. I'm on a Macintosh computer. I've read a fair amount of stuff about the way Apple computer makes its devices in horrible conditions in China, and people are paid very little and they're worked almost to death in toxic conditions. And many people commit suicide. You know, there's actually, anyway, I won't go into that too much, but you know, I have to think, okay, I'm participating in that while we're talking, while we're having this lovely conversation. There's no way to get out of that completely. I do know some people who won't touch a computer for that reason. Somebody who's been a fan of my book who will not get in a car and will not touch money. And it's really inspiring to be with him. And yet some of his friends say, you know, this actually makes it difficult to hang out with him because, you know, we can't do any of the things that take a little bit of money. So there's no real one answer. And I think making the time for contemplation, making choices that seem to be in congruence with your value system as you build your value system. And I would say writing is a good way to reflect on your value system and decide what you think is right and wrong. For me, participating in a lot of television and media, first of all, robs me of a lot of things I want to be doing. For me, not being a landlord and, in my view, being a parasite on somebody else. Here we have this land. We could charge money for it. I don't want to do that. That's community. I don't want to, you know, yes, probably somebody needs housing and maybe I'm saying, oh, you can't live here because it's my private property. So is it really, you know, community building or being stingy? I don't know. You know, I just know that being in a relationship of a landlord and extracting extra money from people because I can is not is something I don't want to do. So, you know, being self-reliant is partly that, you know, I'm not having someone who just needs the money come out here and fix my lights and someone who needs the money come out here and fix my water system. And it feels great to like, you know, be able to organize the rainwater catchment such that in the spring so that we have enough water storage to make it through the dry summer in California. However, last year, a pipe came, a connector came unattached and, you know, about, 7,000 gallons of water. No, no, 1,500 gallons of water poured out onto the ground and we ran out of water. So we found someone who delivered water. We paid the money, and we were in, and he drove a truck, which was powered by gasoline, probably came from Iraq in the war. And we got our water, and he got the $700 we paid him to deliver the water. And I was involved in the, you know, industrial economy to do that. So I think purity is a really bad problem. I mean, it's actually the basis of Nazism, if I'm ranging all over the place, this idea of purity. So we can't be pure. But again and again, returning again and again to our values. What is it that we want to do? How can we help others? How can we give things away? And it's great to be with other people. It's great to give things away. And it's nothing is one way or the other. Gabe, you took a writing class with me maybe 10 years ago. In that class, I charged you money, and you used money that you made to join that class. So in one way, it was a commercial, you know, exchange. But I was so enriched by your novel. And just in case your listeners don't know about Gabe's novel, it's a really exciting and rich piece, and has some overlay with Steppenwolf and just the magic theater. And there's just a really beautiful psychedelic sequence that just blew my mind and enriched my experience of being alive. So in some sense, that was me being in community. You could say it was a commercial experience, or you could say it was a community experience, or you could say it was a consumption experience, or you could say it was an educational experience, but all those are just labels. But to me, that was just a rich moment in my life, having you read me passages from your book.
Well, Andy, I'm left speechless, which is a good place probably to be. I think just feeling the complexity that you just laid out for us in that answer, and seeing the ways that we are all interconnected in complex and challenging ways is very powerful. And I think just on the whole, to be able to consider all that in the context of your work, I would just say that, you know, I've felt a deeper sense these last couple of weeks of lucidity and connection with those around me and the life that I am living. And so I thank you for that. And before we close, Rahul, I just want to pass it over to you. I don't know if you have anything else you would like to add or ask before we close for today. But yeah.
I'll just second what you said there, Gabe, about what engaging with Andy's work did for me as well. I've been ruminating on it quite a bit, and this conversation's only adding to that. And I'm excited just to take that forward and see where that goes. And Andy, thank you. Rahul, thank you so much.
I know we're heading toward the end, but I'm feeling like a little ping inside of me because you wrote me an email where you wanted to ask about the challenging question, which we didn't really get to. And I don't know if you want to, or we're really out of time and we can talk next time. That's fine. About, you know, the criticism that this is too idealistic maybe, or that it's too difficult to do. And I wouldn't want to leave people without that if you feel it's appropriate, and we have a minute or two more to do that. But if not, that's fine too. I can let go too.
No, I appreciate that, Andy. I appreciate your holding that agenda for us. I personally feel like we've actually gotten to it in a more, you know, in different ways and from different angles, and in a, you know, personally feel okay and at peace with that. But Gabe, I'll also check in with you there. Is that a question you want to explore at this point, or should we wrap here?
Well, it's interesting to me that, that's the second time you kind of brought that up, Andy. And I actually agree with you, Rahul. I feel like, it kind of goes back to the origins of our conversation around the narrative versus the takeaway and the thesis. And I feel like that there is elements of that in this last question I asked you too, Andy, around, this isolationism versus participation and connection. And I do feel through kind of the story of this last hour and 20 minutes or whatever it is, that criticism feels, it just feels less pointed. It feels less strong. And that criticism being that this approach is idealistic, not realistic, far-fetched, privileged also. But I do want to second that, but I am curious, Andy, since it is up, before we close, what would you say? Can you give us a takeaway, a soundbite about that? What would you say about that for folks who listen to all of us, made it to this point, listen to all this conversation, and you say, yeah, you know, this is it's a nice idea, but it's not realistic. I can't do it. What would you say to that voice inside each of us and to those that inside of our listeners?
Okay, I will try to break my pattern of being long-winded and say, think about the last days before you die, your own death. Maybe it's not sudden. Maybe you're there in a hospital room. Are you at peace with the choices you've made in terms of the impact you've had on the people that are around you, on the environment that's been around you? Have you felt like that the way that you've spent your days is as much as possible, nothing's perfect, it's been in harmony with the way that you wanted to live? So if the way you want to live is to be more in touch with nature and to have more time to contemplate and more time for your friends, it's the only realistic thing. You've got to figure out what other things got to move out of the way, and what habits you want to break so that you can live that life that you really want.
I love it.
On that note, which is a very powerful note, I'm just going to kind of let it land. Andy, I want to thank you for joining us today. Your time is precious, and I so appreciate you making the time to spend it with us today. I feel very enriched by it. I want to also give thanks, you know, in that context of our participation. You named my son sick, someone's looking after him. That's right. And so I want to thank my wife, Lakshmi, who's spending time with him at the moment, even though she's also, you know, this, when your child gets sick, it usually means that you're also getting a little sick. And so Lakshmi and I have both been dealing with that. And so I thank her for that. And I think I just want to bring that awareness to all of us and to you, if you're listening to this, of just, yes, the ways that we are connected and interwoven and what is happening that's allowing you to be present. Who is taking different steps that are allowing you to be present with this recording right now, and to give thanks to raise that awareness around this whole that we are participating in. Andy, it's just been so rich. I'm curious if you have any last parting words for us before we sign off for today.
I want to say that if any of your friends or listeners are listening, and if it feels right to you, Gabe, if you invite it, would encourage your listeners and your friends to ask you regularly about your book, and encourage you and give you the support so that I can live in a world, selfishly, that has that book available to me in it. And that, again, only if you'd like to be bugged or asked by the people you know about your process and finishing and completing and getting it out. That's what I would like to end with.
Well, thank you. And on that note, you know, you when we were prepping for this episode, you brought that up and you ended up making a connection for me with a fellow student of yours who recently moved to Maui. And we have a writer's salon going on, and I'm meeting him for the second installment of that salon tomorrow for lunch.
Wow.
So
great. Great.
So little things are in motion, and yes, I appreciate that. And yeah, that's, I think that's how things take shape in the world. So, thank you, Andy, for your encouragement personally, and just thanks for all the, insight and wisdom you've shared, all just the personal reality and humanity you've shared with us today. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
So, Rahul, any last thoughts from you?
All good.
Okay.
Spread it forward.
Well, listeners, thanks so much.
Give it out. Yeah. Give it out. Give it away. Help other people. Be kind.
Thanks, Andy. And we will see you all next time as we continue our journey with Woven Wings Live, and just wishing you all a really wonderful day connected to the depth of what matters to you, that it may be that what you get to spend your time on and enjoy the abundance of less. Take care.
Thank you, guys.